And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Avon and Somerset Police Commissioner Hustings with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Before we get back to the candidates, though, I'm pleased to welcome back Martin Summers, who's had a couple of weeks off. Hi, Martin.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
What did we miss while you were away?
Well, what I'd particularly like to draw people's attention to is President Obama has just been in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. So I'd like to talk about Saudi Arabia. In the United States itself, there is a bill before Congress now to allow victims of the 9/11 attacks potentially to sue the government of Saudi Arabia for complicity in those attacks. And this is constructed around the 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which have not been declassified. And Donald Trump has promised his supporters that if he's elected as president, those 28 pages will be declassified. And it's widely presumed that they will point the finger towards the Saudi state for responsibility in the 9/11 attacks.
Well, I've noticed that the Saudis have hit back by saying, well, if you want to go there, we've got $750 billion of assets in the United States, and we can pull them out anytime we want.
Indeed. And I think that that Obama has been in Saudi Arabia trying to square the circle here on this one, because, of course, he's opposed to what all the other can. You know, virtually it's across the spectrum. It's a cross-party thing in the US that the Saudis should be
suable. Obama has been talking about getting these pages released, hasn't he?
They've all been talking about it, but they don't want to do it. I think one of the fundamental problems with all of this is it implies that the story of the attacks is fundamentally correct, that there were 19 mostly Saudi hijackers and so on. Now, the other thing that's been happening in the US is that architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth they've now got over 2,500 architects and engineers who've signed up to say that the story of how the buildings collapsed is simply non-plausible. And don't forget, most people don't realise that three buildings collapsed on 9/11, not just the Twin Towers. There was a third tower, WTC-7, which also collapsed into its own footprint at free fall speed and without a plane hitting it. So that tends to suggest that if the Saudis were involved, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that the Saudi intelligence services may have been involved, that it also implicates the US intelligence services, and there are other leads that lead in the direction, for example, of the Israeli Mossad. But anyway, the point is that 9/11 is not a done and dusted story. That's the main point I'd make. If you think about it,
main point though is which way is this going to go? Is this information ever going to come out? Because if it is, it looks like the Saudis may crash the dollar.
Well, indeed, but also it may be the run up to a situation. Don't forget, 9/11 has been used as an excuse to attack Afghanistan, then Iraq, and it could easily be used as an excuse to attack Saudi Arabia if you wanted to remove the regime there. But don't forget, the Saudi regime is a brutal totalitarian regime with 30,000 political prisoners, which is also involved in a totally illegal war in Yemen across the border from they basically invaded Yemen. If any other country had done that, if Russia had done that, they'd go bonkers. And of course, they also invaded Bahrain during the Arab Spring in 2011. The Saudi army came over the border to repress the Bahraini population. And at the minute, British British Royal Marines are training the Bahraini army in order to repress people inside Bahrain. And British military personnel are also operating in Riyadh to help with targeting for the Saudis inside Yemen. So we are implicated. If the Saudis are implicated in terrorism in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, in Syria, and also in 9/11, it also implicates the British intelligence services. And I know you've had police and crime commissioners on earlier. One of the things that I think is absolutely necessary as we go forward is that police forces around the world, civilian police forces, have got to stop listening to the rubbish that intelligence services feed them. They've got to make their own intelligence assessments of threats and risks, and they've got to write in the intelligence services of Saudi Arabia and of Britain and of Turkey, for example, MIT, who were involved in the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta, according to Simon Hirsch in the London Review of Books. We're reaching a turning point where ordinary people are beginning to realise that our own intelligence services and the intelligence services of our allies, such as Turkey and Saudi Arabia, are the terrorists. And that's what the civilian police force need to get a grip on. And that's the question I would ask your police and crime commissioners. Are they prepared to start thinking in this way? And also, of course, questioning things like the government's prevent strategy, which is premised on the assumption that people are self-radicalising on the internet, when we know, for example, from the case that happened in the Old Bailey recently, where a chap was able to get off a charge of the West Midlands Police of going to Syria to fight, where he argued quite successfully that he'd basically been recruited by MI6, who were running the organisations that he was going to join.
Okay. Let's have a look at Ukraine now, and an interesting development with Andrei Perubi, neo-Nazi who was very much involved in the coup a couple of years ago in Kiev, has now become Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament.
Indeed, and of course Perubi is the main suspect for carrying out the Maidan massacre, in which 80 protesters and police officers were shot dead by mysterious snipers.
Is the European Union, who's obviously behind this, the Americans too, nurturing the rise of the far right in Europe now?
I think that's what's going on there. And also, of course, the Peribi right wing in the Ukraine have close links with the Turkish military intelligence services, MIT, because they've got a shared anti-Russian agenda. And in fact, that the Crimean Tatars, who are a minority inside Crimea, and most of them, in fact, are quite happy with the new setup inside Crimea, but the Turkish military intelligence services and the Ukrainian neo-Nazis, who are basically in charge in Kiev, are trying to stir them up to create a kind of, a Yugoslavian-style fight inside Crimea. Again, NATO intelligence services are intimately linked with the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine, as they are with Islamist extremists in the Middle East. I mean, the King of Jordan recently said that the Turks are planning to run jihadi operations inside Western Europe. He's our ally, and he's saying that one of our other allies is basically planning to attack us. What are we all going to do about this stuff?
Well, the question of EU and security came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week with our local MP, Conservative MP, Charlotte Leslie, saying this.
Charlotte Leslie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The EU's security is only as strong as its weakest border. So does the Prime Minister share my concerns, not only over Chancellor Merkel's apparent legitimisation of President Erdogan's reservations about freedom of speech, but crucially her decision to liberalise visas, Turkish visas, in a country with such porous Syrian borders and such booming identity fraud? And is he concerned that currently Chancellor Merkel seems to be outstripping everyone in making the case for Brexit?
What I'd say to my honourable friend is it's certainly true, if you're in the Schengen zone, then you're only as strong as your weakest border. That is absolutely right. But we, of course, are not in the Schengen zone. That's the first point I'd make. The second point I'd make is, of course, the Schengen zone has decided to offer visas to Turkish nationals. We have not made that decision, so we won't be making that decision. But remember, a visa is not a right to go and live and work or reside. A visa is a right to visit. And so let's be clear also that those Turks with their visas visiting Schengen countries don't have those rights, and they don't have the right automatically to come to Britain either. Very important to get this clear.
A bit of a googly there from Charlotte Leslie Martin, but there's a serious point. I mean, I was reading just a couple of days ago that the Turkish army is now using live ammunition against Syrian refugees who are trying to free ISIS, and yet we are paying them billions of our taxpayers' money that goes through the EU straight to the Turkish government.
Well, the Turkish government is becoming increasingly unstable. The war with the Kurdish population, because that's what it's turning into in the southeast of Turkey. Hundreds of civilians have been killed. But of course, if this was Syria, we'd be denouncing the Erdogan regime as an abomination and supporting terrorists who are trying to overthrow it.
You say unstable, but surely it's just becoming a very rigid police state. It's quite stable.
It's not stable because you've got 20 million Kurds living in Turkey. 20 million. That's a lot of people. And Erdogan is now talking of all people who voted for the HDP, which is the Kurdish political party, to be denied Turkish citizenship as traitors. That's how far we're going. Now, he's got a lot of support amongst the extreme right in Turkish-speaking areas of Turkey, but in the Kurdish-speaking areas of Turkey, which have 20 million population, he's got zero support. So what you're talking about there is Turkey breaking up, being cut into two bits, a bit like Yugoslavia. And of course, it's not that far away from Yugoslavia. And of course, all of these problems, which we have had a hand in starting, there's quite a lot of evidence to show that the British, in fact, instigated the uprising in Syria, which has now turned horribly wrong, because it didn't lead to a quick victory in the overthrow of Assad. It's led to millions of refugees besieging the EU. But if I was the Greeks, I'd say we didn't want a war in Syria. We didn't want a war in Iraq. You British said you did, and so all of these refugees that are arriving in Lesbos, well, you can have them, because you wanted the war, you can have the refugees. We didn't want the war.
But of course, the US plays a big role in all this as well, and one of the things it seems Obama is trying to do is patch up a few problems around the world before he leaves office later in the year, to let one of these two maniacs, either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, take over, which is rather a worrying world when you consider it's the most powerful nuclear-armed state on the planet. But one of the things that Obama has been doing is trying to get better relations with Cuba, and I spoke to someone who spends a lot of time in Cuba. She's married to a Cuban, Jackie Cannon, a couple of days ago, who's organising an event next weekend you may be interested in.
And Cuba, one moment in time. And I started writing it in January of 2015. And if you remember the agreement or announcement between Raul Castro and President Obama was in December of 2014, and I was in Cuba with my husband at the time, and just one day I woke up and thought, I'm experiencing, witnessing, living a hugely historical moment, and I wanted to record it in some way or another. And so I started writing a book, which took me longer than I expected or wanted, because things kept changing in the whole of 2015. There's another change, and there's another change, and even in 2016, just before Obama's visit to Cuba in March, which I was privileged to witness by, I was in Cuba at the time, I would say things haven't really changed in a sense, because if you actually look at what President Obama's saying and what he said ever since the announcement in December 2014, what he was saying in March 2016, and at every moment since, he has focused a lot on civil society and people-to-people exchanges and wanting to encourage autonomy, if you like. There's a new group of, if you like, self-employed workers, which the US administration is calling entrepreneurs, who are entrepreneurs, but they're very much focusing on that. But their intention to not tolerate the Cuban government, if you really study what they've said, there isn't an acceptance of the Cuban government.
You're talking about this Your book, Cuba, One Moment in Time, next Friday, that's the 29th, a part of the Spanish Circle at St. Bartholomew's Church Hall, St. Andrew's. Can you tell us what's going to be going on and what time it starts?
So that starts 7:30 for an 8 o'clock start, actually, and the focus of that will be, well, I'm hoping that my book will be actually out by then.
That's Jackie Cannon there. And Martin, the situation in Cuba a little bit better, as we're hearing from Jackie, maybe not as much as we've been led to believe, but what's the current state of affairs with the US presidential elections? Obviously all eyes on it, with Hillary Clinton for the Democratic Party and Donald Trump for the Republicans seeming to be the only two in the game at the moment.
Well, Bernie Sanders hasn't given up. And don't forget that what happened in New York was that the role of registered Democrats was closed last October before Sanders had got any momentum going. So plenty of young people and others who were willing to vote for Sanders couldn't vote in the primaries. And of course, when it comes down to it, if Trump is denied the Republican nomination by the big money people behind the Republicans, and Hillary Clinton, who's basically in pocket of Wall Street and the Pentagon, becomes the Democratic candidate, you could have three or four candidates at the final election. Sanders is always, it's always possible for Sanders could run against Clinton and that Trump could run against the Republican establishment. It's not all fixed or sorted, but of course it is still very worrying, not least because more than half the population in the US don't participate in elections, the poor people.
Finally, Bilderberg comes to Dresden. Dresden, it's a little bit worrying. I was looking at this on the internet. It seems to be one of the major centres for the far right in Germany. And the Bilderberg conference is happening just 2 weeks before the Brexit vote here in the UK.
Well, no doubt they'll have plenty to talk about in that case, and not just about Brexit. The banking system is still absolutely on the ropes. Everybody's expecting Deutsche Bank to go pop at any moment, the main German bank. And at that point, the German economy will go down the drain. And that really will be, we really will be out, not in Kansas anymore.
Surely the situation with the banks is that they just keep borrowing and borrowing, as they've done in the United States, no, at astronomical levels.
They've reached the zero interest rate bound on this now. They can't actually keep...
What do you mean by that?
You can't take...
What do you mean by zero interest rate?
Well, we've been reducing interest rates to try and keep the economy going for the last 7 years. But once you've reduced interest rates to zero, you can't reduce them anymore.
Can you have negative interest rates?
Well, you can try and have negative interest rates, but at that point, people take their money out of the bank and the banks crash. Because why would you keep your money in the bank to make it go smaller when you put it under the mattress
if people take it out of the bank, they might invest in stocks and shares or something.
Well, that's what's been going on. The stock market has been goosed up by all of this stuff, but that means it's going to pop. That's what happens with stock markets when you goose them up. And the Brexit vote, frankly, is about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, when nobody is talking about the serious stuff, that the banking system is as insolvent today as it was 7 years ago, and we're about to have another crisis which will be much worse than the last one.
So you don't think that this is the most important vote that's been in this country for the last 40 years then?
No, I think it's an irrelevance and a diversion.
Okay, well, we'll have to agree to differ on that one, Martin. I mean, certainly if there was a Corbyn government was elected after a Brexit vote, it might be some real revolutionary policies in this country.
Well, that's because the economy may have gone down the drain, and therefore more revolutionary solutions might be on the agenda, but they might be on the agenda in Germany as well.
Fascinating. All right, well, thanks very much for chatting to us, Martin. We're going to have a bit of music now from KRS-One, back from the 1990s, 1993 to be precise, and we'll be back with our Police and Crime Commissioner candidates after this.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Okay, so that was KRS-One from 1993. And I think I seem to remember some police officers were disciplined for driving around one part of the country playing that from their squad car at very loud volumes. But that may be my imagination. You can probably find it online somewhere. And that's from 1993, a bit of hip-hop there. We're joined now back again with the candidates for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner, at least as many as we could muster here in the studio. They are the independent incumbent, and that's Sue Mount-Stevens. for Labour. Kerry Barker now joins us, who's just come from a court case down in Hampshire. And for the Lib Dems, it's Paul Crossley, Green Party, Chris Britton. He's an independent too. He's a former chairman of the Avon and Somerset Police Federation, Kevin Phillips. Two people that couldn't join us, two candidates that couldn't join us, is the Conservative, Mark Weston, who's got a sore throat, and UKIP's candidate, Aaron Warren Foote, who's milking his cows. I think we'll start, it's only fair, to with Kerry Barker, to give him a chance for a couple of minutes to tell us why we should be voting for him.
Hello, I'm Kerry Barker. I'm the Labour candidate for the Police and Crime Commissioner in Avon and Somerset. And as you've just heard, I come here from a court case in Hampshire because I'm a barrister. And in Bristol, based, I primarily deal with abuse cases. Cases involving anything from baby shaking through to horrible abuse of people in people's homes, people suffering from dementia, people with vulnerabilities, such as learning difficulties. And it was through that work, being at the coalface, you might say, that I decided to put myself forward for this position. Because, sadly, I've seen over the last 3 years a serious deterioration in policing, in the investigation of these crimes, and in the morale of the police force. It's sunk to very, very low levels. The reason that I give for that has been the lack of leadership and the instability in the Avon and Somerset force, especially with having four chief constables in just under 3 years. And I've seen, I know of, senior experienced detectives who've left the force, who've gone to join other forces because of what's been happening in Avon and Somerset. We have no longer got the expertise we had in the wonderful teams we had, such as Bluestone and the Child Abuse Investigation Team and the Domestic Violence Team, and that's been very worrying.
Maybe Sue, I think it's probably only fair to give you a chance to respond to that. These teams that Kerry's talking about there, it sounds like you just don't have the right system now in Avon and Somerset to deal with these sorts of abuse cases.
I think the operating model was introduced a couple of years ago, and I think that there are concerns about the specialist teams. I think it wasn't all sweetness and light with the specialist teams, in as much as there were very little access on occasions because of rest days and training days and holidays. And I think what the essence is making sure that all officers and PCSOs and police staff have a level of skill that they can be at least the first response to these crimes, and that if they are above a certain threshold, then they will go to the specialist teams.
Well, I think it's a good way to start in part two, actually, because certainly it's before Sue that there seems to have been problems in Avon Somerset Police with the with abuse. Now let's turn to look at child sexual abuse in the context of Avon and Somerset. The Independent Police Complaints Commission announced in November last year they're investigating serious allegations of child sexual abuse by Avon and Somerset Chief Dr. Reginald Bunting. He was force medical officer, not under Sue or Colin Port. In fact, before that, under Chief Constable David Shattuck. He came out of retirement, David Shattuck, last year, calling for the sacking of the Chief Constable. So I'd just like to start, I think, with Kevin Phillips, who's an independent former chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. I don't know if you were able to say anything about this particular case of the allegations against the Avon and Somerset Chief Doctor, the Force Medical Officer, Reginald Bunting, but it does look as if police officers themselves have been reporting this man to the Chief Constable in the past and have simply been ignored, Kevin.
Thank you, Tony. I'm actually going to be very silent on most of this because there is currently an investigation going on. The reality of it is that it was officers and former officers that approached me with regards to the concerns way back when, and I was the one that raised it with the force. So clearly, as an ongoing investigation is going on, I'm not prepared to comment on that.
But it is a bit of a problem, isn't it, when you've got such serious allegations in the background, Kerry Barker, going on at the moment about things historically. I mean, it's almost as if you were saying there that this is something which is only, you know, very recent, that there's been a kind of decline in the ability of the force to cope and to deal with cases of abuse.
Yes, but the, what's happened more recently has been the disbanding of the specialist teams, and we have now what are called omnicompetent teams. Omni, of course, meaning all.
Well, what I'm saying is the specialist teams don't seem to have dealt with this case in the past.
Specialist teams did, with lots of various different cases, and did them very, very well indeed. I've known from 25 years' experience how well they used to behave and react and deal with crimes. I'm not seeing that at the moment. I'm seeing officers attached to cases who don't have the experience. Some don't have the interest because it's not their field of expertise. And whether, let's say you report a rape, whether you get an officer who really knows how to empathise with you, how to deal with it, how to investigate well, or whether you get somebody who really still holds to the view that most rape allegations are false, is a matter of potluck.
I mean, what you're saying is really to do with the police investigating abuse outside the force. This IPCC investigation is something more serious, isn't it? It's abuse going on at a high level within the force.
Well, the force doctor would not be, of course, within the force, but like Kevin, I don't know anything about that case, and so I'm not in a position to comment about it.
OK. For the Lib Dems, Paul Crossley, what do you make of this ability, inside and outside, for Avon and Somerset to deal with cases of abuse, sexual and otherwise?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's right and proper for me to make a comment about a specific case which is under investigation. So what I'd like to do, if I may, is address the question through talking about the generality. It seems to me that, as I said in my very opening remarks, that domestic violence and crimes against women are something that are a serious matter. They have been a serious matter for a long period of time, and it's about time that as a society we took them very seriously. Now, within that, it gets even worse if it's crimes against a child, because we've then got a complete breakdown in trust and the morals about the way we function as groups within society. So I think that we need to be carrying on this work that has come, which I started, I think, with the Savile investigations, of actually looking into historical addresses. But to take up another theme from yours earlier, it's not just people at the top that were doing this. You know, it's people in our care homes that were doing it as well. So we need to have a fundamental change in the way we view this type of crime and make sure that we all agree that it is abhorrent and is not to be put up with and should be prosecuted and seriously prosecuted. And that means that when you've got someone who is quite clearly in distress, then the police officer dealing with that person needs to have a lot of training in empathy and sympathy.
For the Green Party, Chris Britton, what do you make of this question?
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie. Like the others, I'm not prepared to make a comment on a case that's been investigated currently, and I really don't know very much about it at all. I think what might be part of your prompting and stimulation around this is historic cases and the way in which we try and deal with that. I'm currently a Promise mentor, volunteer mentor. Promise is an organisation that promotes mentoring for youngsters, disaffected and disadvantaged youngsters throughout Somerset. And I've been working with the same youngster since he was about 13. He's 27 now. And a couple of years ago, he began disclosing that there was sexual abuse that took place when he was a youngster. And so we're talking about something that happened 20 years ago, and it's very, very difficult for the police to investigate in terms of witnesses. How do you gather the evidence, his recollection of events and the rest of it? But nevertheless, it's been something that's been a huge part of him ever since he was a child, and it has the consequences for him is that he's never officially worked. He finds it really, really difficult to concentrate. He can't do that. Having friends, social relationships, the impact of that type of offending is enormous, and now that we're kind of looking historically at lots of cases, I think the weight of it must have some more significant change for the police in terms of how it undergoes those investigations.
Okay, so finally, you on this IPCC investigation, I imagine you're going to be like others saying, oh, I can't talk about that because it's an ongoing inquiry, but it is serious, isn't it, where there are allegations against the Avon and Somerset chief doctor, Reginald Bunting. He's the force medical officer under the chief constable, David Shattuck, and there are serious allegations that they're looking into now about the way that this was basically not investigated when police officers at the time reported this man's behaviour.
They are serious and they are being investigated by another force. I'm not going to make any further comments, but I think we need to remember what it does the Police and Crime Commissioner do, and the Police and Crime Commissioner is very much the voice of the people, and it's making sure that you listen to those, to not only those who know how to lobby someone like me, but also the quiet voices, listening to those who have been abused, listening to make sure that there is some counselling available for those who have been suffering from sexual abuse. I was told only last week that we have agencies who help children who have been sexually abused, and we now have a waiting list. And we have a waiting list on which there is a three-year-old. That I feel is quite obscene. But let's just go back to the particular issue. And I've campaigned very hard that police should not be seen to be marking their own homework. And I've introduced an independent residence panel, which is a group of lay people who come in and they look at the way that police handle their own complaints. And I'm delighted that not only has that gone very public, but the police have taken very much on board their comments and changed the way they handle complaints. But if we then look at misconduct hearings, we now have, again, something I've campaigned for, we now have all misconduct hearings in public since 2015, and they are now chaired by a legally qualified chair, so not a senior police officer. That, I think, increases transparency into the police.
Okay, start again with you, Kerry Barker. Is it true that police officers won't gain promotion above the level of inspector unless they join the Freemasons? Is that real, or is it a real problem?
It was a long time ago. I started out in the Magistrates Court Service in Cheshire in the 1970s. That was a distinct problem. The influence of the Freemasons over many, many public bodies has changed a lot since then. When I was a Justice Clerk in Hampshire, and particularly in Portsmouth, where there are a lot of Freemason lodges, again, there was a period of time when we had a moratorium upon the appointment of Freemasons as magistrates because there were so many Freemasons in the magistracy. But again, that's changed dramatically since those days.
But of course, how do you know whether someone's a Freemason or
not? Well, because there are lots of Freemasons now, and I'm not a supporter of Freemasons, but there are Freemasons now who will in fact reveal, as happened in Portsmouth in my day, who were Freemasons and therefore enabled us to know and to check.
Okay, Paul Crossley, is this an issue still?
I have no idea, actually. If it is an issue, it has to be rooted out and stopped. There can only be one reason for promotion, and that is competence and being the best person for the job. There can be no other hidden reasons. So you've alerted me to it. If I'm elected, on one of my early discussions in May will be to check that whether it is or is not an issue, and if it is an issue, then it must be stopped. You can't have privileged treatment in a job application process. All job applications have to be open and above all board, done by a set of criteria, and marked and awarded on competence only, not on any backhand favours through a private club
or secret society. Chris Britton, is it true police officers won't gain promotion above the level of inspector unless they join the Masons?
I have no idea on that at all. I think what's interesting is you may be alluding in some way to a previous question where you described the establishment. And I would imagine that Freemasons come under that kind of elusive heading of the establishment, the old boys network. You were able to get into something just not because of the skills or the knowledge or the experience you had, but because of who your mate was. I don't know anything really about the Freemasons, but I suspect it's of that kind of ilk.
Independent candidate Kevin Phillips.
I thought it, in this area it was whether you could play rugby or not, as to whether you got promoted. That was the view I had. The second point is, that probably answers why I've never been invited or promoted, because I never became a Freemason. It's quite interesting, actually, because I think this question has been around for many years, and I do actually remember back in the end of the 1990s that Avon and Somerset tried to be very open about Freemasonry in the constabulary, and actually set up a register for police officers to actually say whether they were Freemasons or not. Now, clearly, it still is, shall we say, open to abuse as to whether people actually want to declare or not. But quite a few people did, and I don't know if it affects the way you get promoted or anything. I think the reality is, you know, it should be on competence, and that's how we should do it.
I mean, one of the reasons I brought the question up is because if you look at some of the oaths that the Masons swear when they're initiated, in, they're pretty chilling, that they should have their throat cut across, their tongue torn out by the root, buried in the sand of the sea at low water mark or a cable's length from the shore where the tide regularly ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours. That's what happens to them if they go against the wishes of the master of the lodge. So at least that's what they're swearing. Whether that actually happens, I think, is a whole nother business. But anyway, Sue, in your experience of and knowledge of this subject, is this still an issue?
I don't believe it is. I think there is this register that police officers have to declare. But as Kevin said, they still have the choice whether they do declare or not.
Well, that's not much of a... It's not like a declaration of interest, is it, where you have to declare your interests? If you can see, there's a little box that says, well, it's only optional at the bottom.
There is a declaration of interest. That's exactly what it is. I can assure you the Chief Constable is not a Freemason. I can also assure you that...
How do you know?
Because I've asked him.
Okay.
And I can also assure you that as far as the robust processes that take place, as far as the promotions are concerned, I don't believe they have any place in today's policing.
Back to Kevin Phillips now. The next question on spy cops. Police are now known to have infiltrated groups of peaceful protesters, formed intimate relationships with campaigners who were not breaking the law, and even had children with them before disappearing into the night. Should officers behind these tactics be prosecuted?
To be totally honest with you, I would say yes, because clearly it's misconduct in a public office. If, you know, whilst there's got to be an element of infiltration if you're actually doing what we would class as an undercover job, shall we say, you have to be able to get within these organisations. But to actually go down the route of, shall we say, bringing somebody else into that web, as you call it, the spider's web, because you're actually going to have, and you've touched on it, children, marriages, and that's people living with a totally false person, isn't it? So, as I say, I think misconduct in the public office certainly touches on it. I know there's a number of investigations gone on and going on as we speak, and that's exactly the same as before. It needs to be looked at, definitely.
Chris Britton, the spy cops, a lot of this actually has been targeted against environmental campaigners.
Yep.
But the most important thing is here is that certainly not, no, you know, it looks as if not it wasn't a serious crime that was going on. Actually, some of these people weren't breaking the law at all.
Yeah. They should be prosecuted. That's a simple answer to that one. What's also equally interesting, when I was reading the current needs assessment, Avon and Somerset Constabulary's 2015 needs assessment, there's a small section which talks about extreme left-wingers, and it's XLW. And the criteria for an extreme left-winger is someone who protested against the Iraq War, protests against austerity. I still, when it's the culling season in Somerset and badgers have been slaughtered, go out on what's called the Somerset Badger Patrol. I don't break the law. I simply walk on public footpaths with a torch and a high-vis jacket in the middle of the night, hoping that my presence will deter shooters from slaughtering badgers. Now, when I met up with my fellow colleagues who do that, we'll meet up in a car park at about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, and there's a police presence sometimes, and there's an anxiety there. I feel kind of, am I being watched and targeted? Possibly I am. I'm not really sure, but yes, it's you know, it's, wouldn't it be great if extreme right wingers were also targeted in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, we were just commenting on the... I mean, it's not in the UK, but it's in Brussels, the way that the Belgian police simply allowed a couple of hundred fascists to run straight into the middle of a peace vigil without stopping them, even though there was the police presence there to do it. Yeah. It was almost as if they wanted to see a bit of a fight going on for the cameras. Anyhow, that's another subject. But on the spy cops, Paul Crossley, what do you make of this? This has been a big international as well as national story. There's now, I think it's called the Pitchford Inquiry into it. But these were kind of Stasi tactics that the police were using against people who hadn't actually broken the law.
I think as a society, we have to ask ourselves whether this is a valid form of policing in the first place. I think that's a question that we need to take up with government. And I think my own view is that we shouldn't be doing this undercover type of spying because it's just not the way to get intelligence. I think there's other ways to get intelligence without doing this sort of, which I would say in the first place, is illegal activity. And I think we're coming back to community policing. If we're having community policing, the people who must obey the law are the police themselves. So I have a real problem with the whole problem with the whole position of spy cops in the first place. So my view is that that should be a debate with Parliament and actually ending the practice.
Kerry Barker, what about the sort of tail end of my question there for you, which is about police behind this being prosecuted?
Well, I just would want to avoid scapegoating. These officers were not doing this thing of their own volition. They were part of an organised campaign, and therefore you're going to go after people, then you go after the senior people who organise it, rather than scapegoating the individuals. That happens far too often. I agree it was unlawful, it was wrong, and we should in fact be targeting the people who set it up in the first place, the supervising officers. And that then goes back to the whole issue of culture and how do you police. Neighbourhood policing and the gathering of intelligence is a very different thing altogether. Something we don't do too well these days, and vital in fact for our future safety.
Sue Mount Stevens.
The law of covert policing has been very lackadaisical, and I think that those who were who have broken the law need to be brought to account. But I think, as Kerry said, it is the fact that there needs to be, and I'm already very aware that there is far more training that's now taking place, but really far more importantly is the increased supervision, because if you are a covert officer, there has to be a constant supervision in order to make sure that you are not breaking the law. There are very clear rules, and they have to be enforced. I think with the Pitchford inquiry, I think that this will be a subject that will be in the public domain very clearly in the next couple of years. There will be a lot of evidence that will come forward. A lot of this will be historic. But all forces have already been told that they will be coming to account, being brought to account. But going back to being, you know, if you are a protester, you're now considered a ne'er-do-well. I think my last protest was against Tesco being developed up on Golden Hill, where I took all my three children to protest, all of us. So maybe we've all been listed as activists now.
Kevin Phillips, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on one point. Whilst we're talking about disciplining the senior people involved in this and the officers that are actually out there on the ground, what we mustn't lose sight of is there's families that will be destroyed by the revelations that come out of this. Because if you have a police officer that is undercover and then gets involved in a relationship and has children, then that clearly leaves a family that's destroyed following on from that. So we've also not got to lose sight of that.
Okay, on to another question, starting with you, Chris Britton. Tasers are lethal weapons. For someone with a pacemaker, the 50,000 volts can kill them instantly. They've been developed in the United States from high-voltage prods used to move cattle around in abattoirs. Do you think they're appropriate for the police to carry around?
No, not really. I can understand the argument where if there's someone who, and I think recently on the telly we saw someone in a tube station where he was wielding a knife, I think, and threatening people with physical harm, going to stab people. And I think a member of the public kind of tried to apprehend him, citizen's arrest or whatever, and a policeman came along and kind of stunned him with a taser in the end to kind of make sure he wasn't capable of hurting anyone. I think it's really, really kind of difficult choice for some police officers, perhaps, who are armed with tasers, to make that judgment call. But in principle, I'm kind of not in favour of it. I think we should be finding better ways of dealing with that. But if it's a question of life and death, if it's a question of physical, real physical harm and danger to someone, then perhaps there's a limited use for it.
Kevin Phillips, for independent candidate, former chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. What do you make of tasers? Because they are, aren't they, lethal weapons?
Seeing as you've touched on the fact that I'm former chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, you probably know what my stance would be on tasers, and I think police officers should be, and I will use the terminology, armed with tasers, because they are a less lethal action than actually hitting somebody with a baton. Whilst I understand that occasions things do happen, and you know, it's not the best outcome sometimes.
I mean, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I would imagine that more less people die if they've been hit by a baton than by a taser. I'm not sure, and certainly you don't know if someone's got a pacemaker. If you fire a taser at them, that could be it, couldn't it?
No, I fully understand that, but the officers that receive tasers are suitably trained. They know when to use a taser and when not to use a taser, and if they actually use it in the wrong instance, then we go back to the discipline procedures, and that's what happens. You know, there would be an investigation if it's done wrong. As I say, the loss of anybody's life is not right, but actually you stun somebody with a taser and more often than not, they're going to be fully recovered within a matter of minutes.
I mean, I suppose one of the questions I'm putting here, and I'm sorry to just keep firing more and more at you, not tasers, questions, is that we could end up at the stage where every police officer and PCSOs, etc., are all armed with these devices.
I would rather have all police officers armed with taser than all police officers armed with genuine firearms. And I wouldn't want to go down that route.
So you put them pretty much in the same kind of bracket, or what?
No, as I said earlier, and as I alluded to earlier, a taser is a less lethal option for actually neutralising a situation that needs to be neutralised.
Hopefully not neutralising a person. But anyway, Sue, what do you make of tasers? Because they certainly are lethal weapons in many cases. I think there's another investigation, IPCC investigation, going on at the moment to the use of tasers within Avon and Somerset. And I don't have the details to handle that, but maybe you could share them with us.
There is an investigation going on, and I haven't got full enough knowledge to share it with you. I think they... I disagree with Kevin. I do not believe that every police officer should have tasers. I think that is a slippery slope. Tasers today, guns tomorrow. I think that they should be given to the officers. There is have a limited use and decided, having been decided by it being risk assessed. I think that if we go back to consent and neighbourhood policing teams, then I think that once we get onto that slippery slope of arming our officers, then we lose that. I think with the issue of body-worn cameras, which all officers and PCSOs will have this year, that will increase the transparency of when tasers are used. I'm also introducing a scrutiny panel to look at the tasers, that filming, that coverage of tasers. So when tasers are used, the lay people will be able to come in and will be able to give feedback to the police, and I will, if I'm elected, I would make that very public.
Okay, Kerry Barker.
It comes back to the general point that police officers are not above the law. If they misuse a taser, then they're acting unlawfully and they should be dealt with and prosecuted for it. I'm also, like the others, against arming police officers, and I'm against the use of tasers except in life-saving occasions.
But the taser
I agree with Sue on this, I'm agreeing you have to restrict the use of tasers, and you have to ensure that people are properly trained in their use. But there are circumstances, and Kevin's right when he says that the baton was used to kill people. And there are circumstances when people die for other reasons when they're being dealt with by the police. What's really important is that those circumstances are investigated properly, independently, and if people break the law, they are prosecuted.
Paul Crossley.
I think we have to make sure that the police that we have on our community streets are able to do the job fairly impartially and with good outcomes. If you've got a position where a policeman is having to resort to force, then you've clearly got something that is not the normal run of interactions. And I think the introduction of body-worn cams, which, as I said in an earlier answer, I would make sure that if there was a complaint on any issue, that the film footage would be available for an appropriate independent inspector. It wouldn't be reviewed just by the police. But I think there is a case that occasionally police can be issued with a thing like a taser, which is much preferable, I think, to batons and any other form of weapon. But I think this should not be a default situation. It should be a risk analysed situation. And I think what we want in policing by consent is our policemen and women to be out on our streets and not covered in armour and weapons. We want them to be policing by consent, and that means we have to do a risk analysis of when the police officer is itself going into a risk situation.
Okay, before we have the last question, Sue wants to come in quickly there.
Just would like to say that it is not the role of the Police and Crime Commissioner to decide on that. It is an operational issue by the Chief Constable, and the Chief Constables as a whole have said they're not prepared to back the Federation on this rollout.
Now, graffiti, once upon a time, it used to be a criminal offence, a criminal damage to spray, but actually now Bristol has become the street art capital of the UK, but a lot of people are worried about the quality control, ugly images appearing all over the place. I just wondered, I think we'll start with you, Kevin Phillips, what you make of the proliferation in graffiti, because some people actually, they think this is a serious issue, and that some of this is criminal activity, that the people doing this should be arrested.
I think we go back down to the terminology that we used earlier.
You have to be quick, by the way.
Yeah, the slippery slope. What started off as criminal damage is now acceptable as street art. But was that the slippery slope? The time we decided to accept that. That would be my answer to that one.
Okay. What about you, Chris Britton, for the Greens?
My first degree is in fine arts, so I'm likely to say that. Graffiti is a wonderful thing. Haven't we progressed from just, using swear words to the fantastic imagery of your local Banksy? I know that they're not all high quality, but it doesn't annoy me. I don't think it's antisocial behaviour.
Okay, Paul Crossley, no, not criminal damage this, no?
Firstly, I think graffiti is criminal damage, and I think we ought to be working with local authorities about the way we control graffiti. And certainly, if there's any offensive graffiti to any section of community, then it has to be removed within 24 hours.
Okay, that's it. Sorry, that's all the time we've got. Kerry Barker, quickly.
Well, the way I walk into the city centre on occasions, down the Gloucester Road and down through Stokes Croft, much of that so-called graffiti is in fact very entertaining. And of course, if the owners of the properties have agreed that it should be there, it's not an offence anyway.
Okay, Sue, finally.
I agree. If the owners have said, then it's not criminal damage, but a lot of graffiti is criminal damage, and particularly when it's targeting vulnerable people, such as homophobic or attacking Muslims, then it should be taken down within 24 hours.
Okay, thanks to our Avon and Somerset Police Commissioner guests, also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Thanks also...